Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the Santa Barbara oil spill and discuss the largest citizen lobby for ocean conservation in U.S. history that took place last week in Washington, where delegations from 24 states held 163 meetings on Capitol Hill to oppose new offshore drilling in the Arctic and along the eastern seaboard. David Helvaag, Executive Director of Blue Frontier, an ocean conservation and policy group, joins us. His latest book is Saved by the Sea, Hope, Heartbreak, and the Wonder of in the Blue World. And he has an op-ed at the Los Angeles Times, Lessons of the Santa Barbara Oil Spill, Leave Petroleum in the Ground. And an article at the Huffington Post with Ralph Nader, The Sea Party Rebellion. Then we'll examine the unrest in Cleveland following the acquittal of a police officer who fired 49 shots at two African Americans after a car chase prompted by the vehicle backfiring, with 15 of the shots fired at point-blank range through the windshield as he stood on the hood. Ronnie Dunn, a professor of urban studies at Cleveland State University, whose research focuses on social policy, racial profiling, racial inequality, and the criminal justice system, joins us. Then finally, we will speak with Julian Zelizer, a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University. He joins us to discuss his article at CNN, Iraq, The War That Won't Go Away. And we will discuss the critical comments by Secretary of Defense Carter about the Iraq military and the recent history of American presidents blaming other presidents for the wars they inherit, as well as presidential challenges blaming incumbents for contemporaneous wars that are not going well. And joining us now is David Helvaag, who's an executive director of Blue Frontier, an ocean conservation and policy group. His latest book is Saved by the Sea, Hope, Heartbreak, and the Wonder in the Blue World. And he has an op-ed at the Los Angeles Times, Lessons of the Santa Barbara Oil Spill, Leave Petroleum in the Ground, and an article at the Huffington Post with Ralph Nader, The Sea Party Rebellion. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Helvaag.
Thank you, Ian.
And let's, because I don't think people are aware of this important meetings that took place last week in Washington, with delegations from 24 states holding 163 meetings on Capitol Hill to oppose new offshore drilling in the Arctic and along the eastern seaboard. And I take it that no sooner had you finished the conference than that you have this oil spill in Santa Barbara.
Right, another predictable disaster. I mean, the Healthy Ocean Hill Day was part of our fifth Blue Vision Summit, where we, every 2 years, try and bring grassroots activists, what I call marine and grassroots or seaweed activists from around the nation to try and have an impact of, I say, restore the blue in our red, white, and blue, because the fact is that people aren't learning lessons. We have these cascading disasters of industrial overfishing, of pollution, oil, chemical, plastic, and nutrient pollution, of loss of our coastal habitat we need for restoration, and on top of that, all fossil fuel-fired climate disruption, which is impacting the ocean. It's warming it. It's raising sea levels. It's changing its basic chemistry with ocean acidification. And so, you know, when we fought here in California in the 1980s and stopped proposed new drilling off our coast, back then it was really energy versus marine pollution. Today, it's kind of a product liability issue. You know, this product uses directed overheats your planet and acidifies your seas. So we came together. We did have, as you say, the largest citizen lobby for marine conservation history, and we lobbied on two things. We sort of set down our markers against bipartisan greed. You know, the president has proposed opening up new oil leases all along the eastern seaboard and in the Arctic by 2017, and it's got a lot of Republican backing, drill, baby, drill. So we went and we made clear that there's going to be political cost in their home districts and states for those who support this. And at the same time, we also lobbied for a pirate fishing bill that surprisingly has bipartisan support that would stop illegal fishing and organized crime on the high seas. So there's signs of hope, but the toughest battle may be just making the transition off of fossil fuels. So there's so much money at stake, and I've certainly seen it from my home waters here in California, where we had a local spill just of bunker fuel when I first moved back here in 2007, Costco Busan, and I went from there directly out to the coast of Iraq, where I was working on a book, Rescue Warriors, on the Coast Guard. And not only the Navy, but the best vessels the Coast Guard had were guarding Iraq's offshore oil terminals. And 3 years after that, I was flying over the BP disaster in the Gulf, where I looked down from a small plane and saw 100 dolphins and a humpback whale trapped and dying near the source. And, you know, these are predictable disasters. I mean, every time we've gone into new frontier waters, we started drilling on piers off California, and Summerlin, California, which was a spiritual center, but the oil men were a lot more secular, and they were dynamiting each other's wellheads. When they lose pressure, there'd be spills. By 1901, the San Jose Mercury News was reporting the whole township was aslime with oil waste. And so Santa Barbara, just up the coast, banned oil piers, and it took 60 years for the feds to convince them that, technology was so advanced, nothing could go wrong. And in fact, nothing did go wrong for 3 days. It was the third day that Union Oil was drilling off Santa Barbara that had a blowout, and the 1969 oil spill in Santa Barbara that covered 35 miles of coastline. That, along with the Cuyahoga River catching fire in Cleveland, Ohio, those sort of the images of those oil-coated birds and that burning river really created the modern environmental movement. And, today we got to get back to the spirit of Santa Barbara 69, where the people said, get oil out. It's, I've been offshore on the rigs. And in fact, in 2000, when I was writing my first ocean book, BP invited me to some of their deep water rigs in the Gulf. And on the second rig, I asked the company man, what happens if you get a spill a mile or two down? His response was, well, Dave, I guess we'll find out when it happens. So 10 years later, we found out. And 5 years after that, there's just a report out that says, hundreds of dolphins, bottlenose dolphins, are still dying every year as a result of the oil they put in the water there. So it's, I'm not saying it's easy. I'm saying it's necessary. The best available science tells us that in order not to blow through 2 degrees centigrade increase in global warming, in order not to have catastrophic impacts from climate disruption, we really need to leave 80% of the coal and 30% of the known reserves of oil, underground or under the seabed. And in California, as a society, we've made that choice. We know we have lots of oil reserves offshore, but we choose to protect our coastal economy and way of life by not drilling for it. And that's the lesson we're going to try and spread to along the eastern seaboard, and certainly, the next frontier waters that we're not prepared for in the Arctic Ocean that just opened up as a result of burning fossil fuels, to go up there and drill for more is insane at many levels, including operationally. The Paul Zunkoff, the commandant of the U.S. Coast Guard, which is the lead U.S. agency up there, has told me that we're not prepared. We don't have the oil spill response, search and rescue capability, even the basic aids to navigation necessary to operate, to have shipping and drilling up there. So we're trying to build a movement that will stop this, and it's taking off. There are 60 towns and cities on the East Coast that have already passed resolutions against testing and drilling. There's hundreds of kayakers calling themselves kayaktivists who've been blocking Shell's latest drilling rig that's parked in Seattle and looking to head up this winter. And last time they sent a major rig up there, it ended up breaking loose from its tow ship and grounding off Kodiak, Alaska, back in December 2012. So we're not ready to drill the Arctic. We're not, and there's no reason to be drilling the eastern seaboard. We should be, developing wind power along the eastern seaboard. There's a tremendous resource there in wind, plus no wind spill ever destroyed a bayou or a beach.
Well, David Helvig, again, is the executive director of Blue Frontier, an ocean conservation and policy group. His latest book is Saved by the Sea, Hope, Heartbreak, and the Wonder in the Blue World. And he has an op-ed at the Los Angeles Times, Lessons of the Santa Barbara Oil Spill Leave Petroleum in the Ground. And he has an article at the Huffington Post with Ralph Nader, The Sea Party Rebellion. But, when you talk about the press coverage of oil-soaked seabirds, that certainly does get people's attention. But I was just watching NBC Network News last night, their coverage of the Santa Barbara oil spill, and you had this reporter from NBC, Holly somebody or other, walking down the beach with the chairman and CEO of Plains All American, the pipeline company, who have an incredible history of infractions and oil spills, and I mean it's a really incredible record, both their company here in the United States and their subsidiary in Canada. And yet this reporter is walking down the beach with this guy as though they were honeymooners, strolling along, having this very friendly chat, no mention of his company's incredible, disgraceful record of problems and oil spills and infractions. And in the end, in this softball interview, the CEO of Plains All American ends up his little public relations spiel by saying, "You know, bad things happen to good people." I mean, I could not believe that I was watching this. It's so pathetic, the coverage of what's really going on and what's at stake in these incidents.
Right. It's like bad people do bad things and the corporate media don't hold them to account. I mean, the LA Times follow-up coverage has showed that this is the only pipeline in Santa Barbara County that doesn't have an automatic switch-off valve when there's leakage, and that's because this company went to court 15 years ago and essentially got themselves excused from a county oversight regulation. And it's the lack of regulation that's the basic problem. You've got, you know, regulatory capture, you know, agencies. Now it's called BOEM. It used to be Mineral Management Service. And years ago I asked the environmental chief for the Department of Interior's Oil Regulation Agency, Mineral Management at the time, BOEM today. I said, how come in the history of your agency you've never canceled an oil lease based on your own oil spill risk assessment? His response was, well, Dave, something as major as a lease, you're not going to cancel it on one issue. So clearly we don't have the regulatory agencies regulating, and we don't have most of the media speaking truth to power. So it's going to require, you know, a real popular movement of coastal citizens, of economists, of some of our ocean champions, which we do have. When we went back to D.C., our Blue Vision Summit was addressed by, you know, Senator Sheldon Whitehouse of Rhode Island, the ocean state, Ed Markey of Massachusetts, Brian Schatz of Hawaii. I mean, we have people who do speak out on climate and ocean. We have, you know, our own, you know, the head of the Alabama delegation, when we were doing our report back the day after Hill Day, she said, I hate you Californians. You just have a love fest, and I have to deal with my state delegation. But it's true. I mean, California is a model. We're the most populous state, 39 million people, and the world's sixth largest economy, and we have a commitment to protect our coast and ocean. And as a result of doing it the right way, we have benefits. Unfortunately, there's inconsistency when, you know, when a judge will rule against, say, the county of Santa Barbara and let this pipeline operate without oversight. That's when disaster strikes.
Well, can they do something about this judge, the citizens of Santa Barbara? Has he been named?
Yeah, I believe it was I don't have the details. Hopefully, if it's an elected judge, they could unelect him, but more likely it would have been a federal appeal, in which case they don't have much control. What we do have control is, you know, keeping additional operations offshore, which we did in the 1980s. There was a proposal under Reagan to create 1,100 new drilling sites, and the people of California were very clear they wouldn't tolerate that. Now, I talked to Secretary of Interior Sally Jewell. I got to ask her a question if they were going to try and drill off the West Coast, and she said, no, we're only going where the governors would welcome us. So basically she's admitting it's political, and what we're doing along with the summit, we had our 8th annual Peter Benchley Ocean Award, and along with giving awards to people like Secretary Kerry, who's been good on ocean issues, and Daniel Pauly, who's a leading scientist on fisheries. We gave our Hero of the Seas, our grassroots award, to the heads of the North Carolina and South Carolina Coastal Federations, who've not only restored 1 million acres of coastal wetlands over the last 20 years, and people don't appreciate that, and restored, you know, rebuilt oyster reefs, but But all of that's at threat because the Carolinas are ground zero for this proposed offshore oil, along with Georgia and Delaware and northern Florida. So people are organizing on the ground, and part of the idea of the Sea Party is, you know, we got better costumes than the Tea Party and a lot better idea, which is, you know, that our public seas ought to be protected for the public, and that there's a blue economy of tourism and recreation and defense and port operations that are put at risk when we start drilling for fossil fuels again. So I think this is actually, you know, we beat this back 25 years ago in California. I think that with enough organization, we can really turn things around. And part of it is, you know, we're going to show up in the primary states and hold the candidates responsible and see if we can get, it's a tough nut to crack, but try and get Hillary Clinton to come out against drilling. I know her campaign chief, John Podesta, was good in the Obama White House, good on ocean issues and marine protection. And as I said before, you know, I've been out on the rigs and I enjoy hanging out with the roughnecks and roustabouts, but I feel like I'm on a whaling ship in the 19th century. You know, they've made their contribution to maritime history, but it's time to move on. You know, coal and oil were great energy systems in the 16th and 19th century, but we're in the 21st, and the science tells us we can't do this anymore.
Well, then, is there anything, though, that can be done, do you think, to change the corporate press's coverage to the extent to which they appear to have been giving particularly the Plains All-American Oil Company a free pass here, at least the NBC report certainly did? I mean, this guy, you know, apologized for the inconvenience that he was causing or his company was causing. But Wednesday evening, the company spokesman said that they had experienced mechanical issues, but they refused to elaborate. And now, of course, you're saying that it's one of the oldest pipelines and it doesn't have an automatic shutoff valve. And they managed to sue to keep this pipeline going. So, you know, talk about missing the story. It's just mind-boggling.
No, after, you know, I came to my nonprofit after, you know, 30-plus years of reporting, and as a journalist, it's kind of embarrassing to now see the fake news is doing better journalism than the corporate mainstream news. I mean, you know, that you look to comics like John Oliver to do serious investigative reporting, but there are also new outlets like Vice, and there are watchdogs like yourself that, you know, that encourage the better lights among us. I mean, even at NBC, you have somebody like Ann Thompson who has done good environmental reporting. And the challenge is, you know, not to accept the BS. I mean, last fall I went to the convention of the Society of Environmental Journalists in New Orleans, and the new spokesman for BP stood up there, former spokesman for the Pentagon, the guy who used to tell us how well we were doing in Iraq, got up and gave this talk about how, you know, the story we're missing is the resiliency of the Gulf. The beaches are better than ever. And, you know, to me, like a BP spokesman talking about the resiliency of the Gulf's like a, you know, it's like a Vatican spokesman talking about the resiliency of abused youth. It just, it's inappropriate. And we, you know, again, we need to be engaged citizens, holding our press to account, just as we hold or try and hold these sort of runaway, you know, corporations. But it can happen. I live in Richmond, California, and we've got a big Chevron plant that was first built there in 1906, a couple of years ago. In 2012, it had a explosion, and thousands of locals went to area hospitals with respiratory distress. And in the last election, they spent over $3 million, like $270 on me and every other voter in town, trying to win back the city council. It was like $800,000 for each of their four candidates for $18,000 a year city council seats. And we had grassroots organizing, went door to door, and to put it directly, we kicked their ass. All four of the candidates lost and all five of ours won. So it's like I told Ralph Nader, when it's corporations versus progressives, you can actually win elections. When it's, you know, Republicans versus jellyfish is when you lose.
Well, David Helvager, thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you so much, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with David Helvaag, who is Executive Director of Blue Frontier, an ocean conservation and policy group. His latest book is Saved by the Sea, Hope, Heartbreak, and Wonder in the Blue World. And he has an op-ed at the Los Angeles Times, Lessons of the Santa Barbara Oil Spill, Leave Petroleum in the Ground, and an article at the Huffington Post with Ralph Nader, The Sea Party Rebellion. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into the unrest in Cleveland following the acquittal of a police officer who fired 49 shots at two African Americans.
In this sacred land, it has seen many hands. It has wealth and gold, yet it is fragile and old. And now the greedy souls just don't care to know all the changes it will confront. So you know some people, they just won't understand.
Are you really for peace and equality? Or when my car's hooked up, you know you wanna follow me. Your laws are minimal, 'cause you won't even think about looking at the real criminal. This has got to cease, 'cause we be getting hyped to the sound of the police.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Ronnie Dunn, who's a professor of urban studies at Cleveland State University, whose research focuses on social policy, racial profiling, racial inequality, the criminal justice system, issues affecting children and families living in urban areas, minority populations, and the urban poor. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ronnie Dunn.
Thank you for having me, Ian.
And Ronnie, what's the latest in Cleveland following the acquittal of the police officer, Michael Brello, who took part in an unauthorized 59 police car chase following a car that drove by the police station that backfired, which the police then took for a gunshot. A car chase ensued in which 137 shots were fired. 49 shots were fired by Officer Brello, 15 of which were fired at point-blank range through the windshield at Timothy Russell and Melissa Williams. And he was standing on the hood firing at them after how many other shots had been fired as well. And yet this guy gets acquitted. It's mind-boggling. And, of course, they release the verdict on Saturday of the Memorial Day weekend, in the hope that people are not paying attention or on vacation.
Yes, Ian. As you said, the verdict was very unsettling for the community. But needless to say, I don't think most people were surprised, in that we know it is very rare that, first of all, a police officer is indicted for deadly use of force or homicide, and secondly, a conviction is even that much more rare. So while there's definitely disappointment and anger and frustration in the community, I think most people were prepared for such a verdict.
But this chaotic car chase that took place back in 2012.
Yes.
So this is both justice denied and justice delayed.
Yes, it is. Actually, that case is receiving much more national and international attention than it did when it first occurred, which was amazing to me, in that this is the most egregious use of deadly force that I am personally aware of in all of my professional research, given that these individuals died in a hell of 137 gunshots. That is more than what was used to kill Bonnie and Clyde, who had killed 9 law enforcement officers and 21 people nationally. So it's amazing that this did not receive much more attention when it first occurred.
And does anybody know, because the victims are dead, why they didn't stop, why this car chase went on for so long?
Well, they did. There are a number of factors that haven't really been publicized, Ian. Undercover police officer had attempted to make a stop, a traffic stop, in an unmarked vehicle prior to this their car, them going past the police headquarters at a high rate of speed, at which time their automobile backfired, thus creating the ensuing police chase. So that didn't come to light until some time after the actual incident. But a police officer in an unmarked vehicle had attempted to execute a traffic stop at a red light. Now, mind you, if someone is approaching your vehicle and you have no idea this is a police officer at night, then they might have thought they were about to be robbed or something of that nature. Now, Timothy Russell did have a history of fleeing from the police, and they had substance abuse problems. They were drug addicts, and Melissa Williams had mental health issues as well. And the toxicology report did show cocaine in both of their systems.
And again, I'm speaking with Ronnie Dunn. He's a professor of urban studies at Cleveland State University. His research focuses on social policy, racial profiling, racial inequality, the criminal justice system, issues affecting children and families living in urban areas, minority populations, and the urban poor. But there's also been in Cleveland this other case of Tamir Rice. I think he was like 12 years old, a young boy, yeah, brandishing a plastic weapon, which I don't know why they make replica guns in the first place. It's bad enough that they make so many guns, let alone replica guns. But in any case, that footage has been seen everywhere of the police car just pulling up really fast, boom, the guy gets out and starts shooting. It's just obvious. And then the worst part of it is the victim's young sister comes running forward because her brother's been shot several times. And he, the other cop, tackles her and really treats her roughly. And it's only apparently when an off-duty FBI man comes by and looks at the boy and tries to administer some first aid, that the police even pay any attention to the kid that they just shot. That's the part of it that worries me. And I've seen so many incidents of this kind of callousness that is not supposed to be a part of police profiling and training.
Yes, you're absolutely right, Ian. These officers, they fail to follow proper police protocol and training from the very time they approached young Tremere. First of all, they did not maintain the appropriate distance from what you perceive to be a potentially armed suspect. They drove immediately up upon him, and at that point, this rookie officer, his partner, basically put him in a position where it was inevitable that there would be the deadly use of force. Now, mind you, we're talking about a 12-year-old minor. In his mind, they say he was reaching for the gun. He was likely reaching for it to tell them it's only a toy. But obviously, he fired within a second and a half upon them confronting Tremere, and they claim that they warned him to raise his hands three times. There's no way you can even utter that three times in a second and a half.
Well, but this cop who shot the boy, he apparently had been hired very recently by the Cleveland police from a rural police force somewhere in Ohio, and they had fired him. This rural police force had fired him because of he had the wrong temperament. And, you know, you'd think that the standards for a big urban police force would be higher than that of a small rural force.
Yes. They failed to even do the appropriate background check. It was clearly in his records. He had been fired from the Independence Police Department, which is a suburb of Cleveland. And in his file, it said he is unfit to be a police officer or carry a weapon. He failed. He had a emotional breakdown at the gun range, and there is no way that he should have been able to be hired on any police force, particularly policing urban areas where there's large minority populations, which he obviously is not accustomed to interacting in a diverse setting of that nature. So the police department failed to do their due diligence and the background check.
Well, this case that we started out talking about, where the officer was just acquitted on Saturday, even though he stood on the hood of this car that had been riddled with bullets and fired point blank through the windshield 15 times at these two people, and some of the shots killed the people, even though they were had 137 shots had been fired in total. Yet he gets off. That took, what, 2-plus years. How long is this Tamir Rice the inquiry taking?
Actually, I think yesterday marked the 6-month anniversary of Tamir's death, the shooting of Tamir Rice. That case is currently being investigated by the county sheriff. The city turned the case over to the sheriff's department. I think they've likely had it maybe 4 months at 4 or 5 months at this point. So the sheriff's department issued a statement last week stating that they don't want to rush the investigation and make sure they do a thorough, appropriate investigation.
So, given that the judge decided to release his verdict on the Saturday of a Memorial Day weekend, there have been some protests, and the Cleveland Cavaliers are playing tonight, are they not, in Cleveland?
Yes, they are. They are playing their first home game of the second round of their series against the Atlanta Hawks. So I do not know if any protests are planned for that event, but I would not be surprised if some groups do show up to protest that event outside the event.
And so what are the local authorities? I think Governor Kasich basically told everybody they have to accept the verdict, which it's pretty hard to accept, frankly.
Well, yes, unfortunately, as I said, it didn't go the way that many in the community would have liked to have gone. But at this point, the community has to respond to this verdict. Now, actually, I think that this verdict is a prelude to the decision made by the prosecutor in the Tamir Rice case. I think it kind of raises the stakes at this point. And there's also another case, that of a mentally ill woman that died in the custody of police when her family called for a welfare check. Her name is Tanisha Anderson, and she died a week prior to the Tamir Rice investigation. So we still have these other two cases pending. So given the way that the verdict went yesterday, I think that kind of raises the stakes on these the decisions on these other two cases, particularly that of Tamir Rice, a 12-year-old child doing what 12-year-olds do, the innocence of a youth, and for his life to be taken in the manner that it was. So I think it really puts a lot more pressure and raises the stakes on the prosecutor and other public officials in the city.
Well, it does, but What about the judge? I mean, you know, he
well,
the,
yeah.
The prosecutor's getting blamed
for
even bringing the case forward by the police.
Right. Well, the prosecutor has to be commended, first of all, I would say, for even bringing an indictment. In a sense, this verdict now, it is kind of passing the buck to the prosecutor. He'll have to make the call on this other case. So it raises the pressure there. But the judge himself, now mind you, he obviously has higher political aspirations. So that will be up to the community how they, when he runs for another re-election or another office, what their response is at the polls.
So, but what is this the prosecutor, Timothy McGinty, does he, is he, you said he's handling the Tamir Rice case as well, and Tanisha Anderson, is he doing both?
Well, as far as we know at this point, once the investigation is concluded, then the it'll be presented to the prosecutor, and it'll be up to him to determine whether or not it goes before the grand jury.
So, and the judge, though, John O'Donnell, is you think he may be running for what, county office or a congressional office?
What? He did run for the Ohio Supreme Court this past November, and he wasn't successful. But that indicates he does obviously have higher political aspirations.
Well, it. Tell me about the politics of the state of Ohio. Is somebody like that likely to get elected? How conservative? I mean, it's. Not exactly great thing to burnish your resume, is it? To you let this guy off when the evidence is so damning.
Well, yes. The thing is, as you know, Ohio is a battleground state. Now, it's the political landscape of Ohio is very interesting. And ironically, the 137-shot incident occurred on November 28th or 29th of 2012. That November 4th, the presidential election, Cleveland was the center of the political universe. In that we once Cuyahoga County, of which Cleveland is the metropolitan core, the urban core of the county, the seat of the county. Once it went, the results came in. That's what sent Barack Obama over the top, and he was reelected. And the same in 08. Cuyahoga County and Cleveland in particular is the Democratic stronghold in the state of Ohio. Now, the southern Ohio and the remainder of the state, it tends to go Republican. Outside of the urban areas, the major urban areas tend to go Democrat. But Northeast Ohio and Cleveland in particular are the Democratic strongholds in the state. County government, city government, all Democrat. So these conditions have come about and been able to persist under Democratic leadership at the highest level. And that's one of my critiques, is that we've had African-American and Democrat leadership at the highest level of local government going back almost 50 years with the election of Carl Stokes, the first African-American mayor of a major U.S. city.
Well, Ronnie, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but we've run out of time, and I appreciate you joining us here today.
Okay, my pleasure, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Ronnie Dunn, who's a professor of urban studies at Cleveland State University. His research focuses on social policy, racial profiling, racial inequality, the criminal justice system, issues affecting children and families living in urban areas, minority populations, and the urban poor. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back talking about the recent history of American presidents blaming other presidents for the wars they inherit, as well as presidential challenges blaming incumbents for contemporaneous wars that are not going well.
hymn book down by the riverside, down by.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Julian Zelizer, who's a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University and a New America Fellow. His books include Governing America, The Revival of Political History, and his latest is The Fierce Urgency of Now, Lyndon Johnson, Congress, and the Battle for the Great Society. He has an article at CNN, Iraq, The War That Won't Go Away. Welcome to Background Briefing, Julian Zelizer.
Thanks for having me.
And certainly the war that won't go away is coming back to haunt Republican presidential candidates. A week or so ago, Jeb Bush got tied up in knots, and so did Marco Rubio. Now you've got Senator Lindsey Graham, who's about to announce he's running for the presidency, calling for sending an additional 10,000 American troops back into what I think most Americans see as an unending quagmire. Is there some poetic justice in this, in the sense that the architects of the original Iraq War, George W. Bush and Dick Cheney, have never really been held to account, have they?
Well, the party will be held to account, and I think that's what the Republican candidates are learning, that first, controversial and unpopular wars don't go away, and the party that's seen as responsible for the war must deal with it long after the president who started it is gone. And the other thing is the war never ended. And so the war in many ways is ongoing, even though the original mission was fulfilled. And so Republican candidates can't free themselves from both interpreting what they would have done, but talking about what they would do now. So the burden is very heavy for all Republicans.
And when the Secretary of Defense, Ashton Carter, goes public and basically castigates the Iraqi forces for being unwilling to liberate the city of Ramadi, how does that strike you? It's as though this government that inherited the mess is basically saying, you know, it's not entirely our problem.
Well, I think, you know, the Democrats and certainly the administration are trying to make the case that the success of ISIS, its emergence, isn't their fault, and that's the argument Republicans are going to make, that the situation in the Middle East isn't because of the former presidents, because of this president. And so what the administration wants to do is explain the policy was always flawed. And so there's a number of arguments that they make, including the idea that the government we put into place, the government we have supported, has never been stable, and the military has never been very effective. And so we're constantly dealing with this fragile situation that, because of President Bush's policies rather than Obama's, they argue, leads us to this moment.
Well, that's exactly the argument that Jeb Bush tried to make when this young woman, young student, confronted him and basically said that your brother created ISIS. Jeb Bush was saying that this is all Obama's fault because he withdrew, not mentioning the fact that Obama was basically stuck with the agreement that George W. Bush had made with the Iraqis to withdraw.
Right. And so you'll hear more of this. I do think Democrats are going to have to deal with this as well. While the argument has a logic, the reality is whatever the origins of a war, you know, the president currently confronting with the situation often shoulders the blame. You often heard this with Vietnam. Johnson blamed Kennedy. Nixon blamed Johnson. And each president tried to argue that it was the previous president who's responsible for the mess. But voters will often take it out on whoever's in the White House. So this is a war where I think both parties are going to have to figure out, the candidates, how to deal with this legacy and with the ongoing situation.
So is it possible then, Julian Zelizer, that is there a game changer in this? Because as far as I can tell, there's a certain fear in America about the Islamic State, even though they're not active over here. The graphic killing of journalists, et cetera, on television certainly got a lot of people's attention and was the reason why the U.S. got back in, even with this light footprint that they have. But let's say, for example, they destroy the city of Palmyra, which is actually a real possibility. Would you think that would be a game changer? In other words, there would be more of a clamor to get put boots on the ground?
I'm not sure that will do it. You know, the fact is, traditionally, the U.S. Is wary of intervention, and since Iraq, it's even more so. And I think American voters are naturally suspicious. And the bar is very high right now for committing troops again at some serious level. You know, the videos raised concern, and you saw the polls change, the videos of beheading. I do think territorial expansion is something that is significant and could be a game changer in that the kind of merger of ISIS with actual territorial gain is something that can be seen as a threat. But I'm not sure. I'm not sure if Americans and their representatives don't see an immediate threat to U.S. citizens, that it will be impossible for a president or a candidate or Congress to muster the support necessary for another huge intervention. Kind of Americans, I think, need a real tangible threat here in the U.S. I don't think they're yet as concerned about changes that are taking place in other regions.
So is there any possibility here then of an October surprise? It sounds as though if America's war weary, there's nothing that's going to get them excited as say shock and awe did when we first went into Iraq.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. An October surprise usually connotes something that is being kept from the public and revealed at the right moment politically. So, you know, you heard this in 1980 about a deal for the hostages in Iran, and you've heard it at other moments. I think, you know, the event that could take place, barring some U.S. attack on an attack on U.S. soil by ISIS, would be not just securing a city by ISIS, but an entire country, and where the press interprets it as ISIS now formally having its own state. The merger of terrorism and statehood, I think, is something that could certainly change public opinion here in the U.S., something like we saw with the Taliban and al-Qaeda. I think that would be the situation we'd need, where you'd see a change in public opinion to move beyond simply being concerned about ISIS towards supportive of another U.S. mission.
So in terms of history, as an historian, you know, when you are just reading your CNN article, Iraq won't go away anytime soon, and you just list all of, going back to Woodrow Wilson and Dwight D. Eisenhower with Korea, and how all of these wars have been politicized. And it really makes you wonder, where did this idea of bipartisanship in foreign policy come? I mean, one of the most egregious examples, I think, is the possibility that Richard Nixon, through intermediaries, encouraged the South Vietnamese to walk out of the peace talks that President Johnson had arranged to end the Vietnam War. So, you know, I think there's a certain amount of truth to that. You know, that's even more egregious. That's really sort of treasonous, you can argue.
That's what Lyndon Johnson argued. You know, there's different kinds of examples of how wars become and remain political, as we're seeing with Iraq. You know, one is just that they become a permanent part of the partisan debate. So the stalemate in Korea in 1952 and 53 became a standard argument of Republicans to prove that Democrats didn't know what they were doing on national security policy. And we see this again and again. Then there's very specific instances where politics has a profound effect on foreign policy, and the case you just mentioned is probably the most famous. And Lyndon Johnson knew about it. He called it privately to Everett Dirksen, a senator from Illinois. He said this was treason, but he never went public with it because he didn't want to reveal that the FBI was wiretapping the Republicans during the campaign. But the second thing you learn is often the consequences are negative. So it's not just that they become political, but the whole idea that presidencies benefit from war usually isn't the case. And while there might be short-term boosts in a president's standing, what usually happens is for generations, the party of the president, as we see now, has to deal with the fallout and costs of the war that they fought.
But this, of course, is we're talking about in terms of Iraq and the Islamic State, and of course, they're active as well in Syria. This is a new phenomenon, is it not? This transnational threat. You know, we've dealt with some much more serious threats like the nuclear-armed Soviet Union in the past. And yet, you know, under George W. Bush, the global war on terror, there was a lot of hyperbole about, particularly after 9/11, how much we're threatened. And frankly, there was no comparison to the idea that every city in the United States that was targeted with nuclear weapons, they could be incinerated in 30 minutes. That was the threat back then. Is there any sense that anybody is talking about proportionality here when you talk about what the threats that we have survived in the past, and all the wars that you just mentioned, even though they weren't world wars, they were still real wars? How real is this war that we're in now?
Yeah, I mean, that's a good question. Fear is usually the way in which debates about these issues take place, and proportionality is not something we discuss. So we don't discuss how this compares to a nuclear confrontation with the Soviet Union, or even how ISIS compares to the threat that al-Qaeda posed to the United States in the early 2000s. It's a different kind of war. It's a stateless war at this point. So we're not dealing with the head of a government or a particular government. It's also, to many Americans and politicians, a little bit amorphous in terms of what we're fighting or what we're fighting for, beyond dismantling a terrorist network that exists in different areas. And so it's a tough war. It's not a war where you can simply defeat the enemy and protect territory. That's a fundamental difference in some ways with some of the earlier wars. This is an ongoing effort to try to root out these networks. But part of the problem is that's not always a military solution. This involves weakening their local support, which also means finding and supporting governments that will not simply anger the local population and put people in the hands of a group like ISIS. So it's a really messy war in some ways. And at the same time, because it's messy and it's unclear, I think there's certain ways in which policymakers can exacerbate the fear levels, because it's not as clear what the bad is that can come of this.
So in terms of this presidential race, and with a number of the Republican candidates, particularly Jeb Bush, getting tied up in knots over trying to figure out how to discuss the Iraq war, and I also mentioned that it also, to some extent, caused Senator Marco Rubio to stumble. What I find extraordinary, though, is I don't know whether you saw Saturday's New York Times front page story suggesting that the Democrats were actually really worried about a Marco Rubio candidacy. And if you read the article, the assumption is that because Marco Rubio is of Latino descent, he can therefore appeal to the Latino vote. And I find that extraordinary, that the assumption is that Latinos in this country will just vote for somebody because they're Latino, as opposed to what their policies are. And given how the Republican Party has been so hostile to immigration, even though Rubio tries to be more nuanced than his Republican colleagues on that issue, nevertheless, the party has a lot of stigma as far as Latinos are concerned. So what did you think of that premise?
Well, I think the idea they will just vote for a Marco Rubio, a Hispanic voter, because a Cuban American is running, it might have, we hear this all the time. This is a traditional argument, so it's not new about Rubio. There's often speculation on how a candidate from a particular constituency will win over votes. You heard this about JFK back in 1960. I think it won't work that easily, and I think in general the Hispanic vote has gone in the last few elections because of policy and because of what hardcore Republican anti-immigration groups have done toward the Democrats. But that said, I do think, A, that the Hispanic vote is not locked in totally to the Democratic Party. Many Hispanics are frustrated with both parties. So it's not simply that Rubio is of a certain descent. It's can someone with a different kind of more pro-immigration policy within the GOP swing enough Hispanic voters in states like Colorado to make a difference? And the other part the article didn't mention is that part of the appeal, I think, of a Rubio is that he will excite non-Hispanic Republican voters who see him as giving the party a different image. So not being that hardline anti-immigrant. I think that's the other way in which he's a threat. So it's overstated that, just putting him on the ticket somehow shifts a whole demographic. But I do think he can have a pretty positive effect for the Republican electorate, including white Republican voters who might be more excited about him than Bush, in part because of this image and change of tone that he would give the party.
Well, of course, Obama's initiative, executive order that upset the Republicans, is being tied up by a very conservative judge in Texas. So to some extent, they've stymied Obama, which could lead to a sense with the electorate, a plague on both their houses. But, you know, when you look at what's happening with the Senate now, with Mitch McConnell being seemed to be tied up in knots as well, how do you think just that the Republicans are going to make a case that, you know, as they did when they got elected in this last midterm, that now we're going to show that we can, you know, run a government because they spend so much of their time denouncing government itself? But that's not happening, is it?
I think they're going to make a case just by trying to recreate the playing field. I think, you know, the hope is that congressional obstruction is something that doesn't translate into how voters look at presidential candidates. And, you know, probably most of these Republican candidates, including Rubio, including Rand Paul, will run against Congress. They'll run against Washington. And the way in which candidates try to do this is to separate themselves from the congressional wing of the party, even if they're part of it. And what they'll do as president, they'll argue, is to govern in a different way. And they'll make the argument that if you have united government, you're more likely to have effective government, that the problem isn't simply the Republicans. They'll say it's division and that we need a moment of unity and we need a president who can then take advantage of that. Will it work? I don't know. The congressional Republicans have badly damaged their brand name. But we're looking at a Democratic candidate, Hillary Clinton, who's very strong, very exciting, but also has vulnerabilities. And we've seen them. We've been reading about them. And so I think a lot of Democrats are genuinely still uncertain about, you know, how easy or smooth this contest would be, especially if Republicans can find someone who can excite their electorate and bring people out and get the money out.
Well, Julian Zelizer, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thanks for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Julian Zelizer, who's a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University and a New America Fellow. His books include Governing America, The Revival of Political History, and his latest is The Fierce Urgency of Now, Lyndon Johnson, Congress, and the Battle for the Great Society. And he has an article at CNN, Iraq, The War That Won't Go Away. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.